Welcome to the Longest Stride Podcast. Each week, we bring you engaging conversations with the global running community. We interview community builders and leaders and the incredible runners who inspire us all. We're by runners for runners. And now, here's your hosts, Jonathan Greenwald and Andre Morgan.
Welcome to the Longest Stride. If you've been listening to some of our previous episodes, you'll know we've been talking about racing a lot lately. It probably has something to do with live racing making a comeback, or at least in the United States, or the great work race directors are doing to make racing more inclusive. Today, we're excited to speak with Charlotte Brooks and Corey Friedman, race directors for Canada Running Series, Sporting Life 10K, Toronto Women's Series, and others. Please welcome Charlotte and Corey to the pod.
Glad to be
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. I appreciate you both make the time to be on our podcast, or like Humble Little Podcast. But there's a general theme that Jonathan and I are obviously trying to bring together on the podcast is these different behind the scenes from different races and just professionals yourselves as race directors to then have the average Joe know how it works without giving away too much, right? So my first question, I'm going to direct it towards Charlotte. Your background on CRS, some of us know a brief description on it. So tell us a little bit about the background on CRS and yourself.
Yeah, sure. So the Canada Running Series was started back in 1990 by Alan Brooks. He was a professor at the University of Guelph, and my mother got him into running as a way to get healthy. And so, like most things that he does, he gets super passionate about them and takes them to the next level. So he quit his job at the University of Guelph with tenure, opened a running store called Runner's Choice, and then started these road races. And from there, it went from Toronto to Vancouver and Montreal in 2003. And then back in 2018, we actually added for the first time since 2003, a new city with the Edmonton 10K through Lululemon. So been at it for a long time. Alan is my father, so I argue I was born into the business, have been around for quite a long time. I have a photo of myself at the New Hamburg 10K, I guess, in Ontario. I was in diapers and he had me in front of a stack of shoes, trying to get people to buy shoes from a baby. So it's good. Yeah, humble beginning. But I did my undergrad at York in HR, and then and started working for him full time in 2005. So I've been at the office at it from the very beginning of the company, customer service, up to the top now as a national event director.
Yeah, and I will speak to the experience there.
Yeah, we have so many questions about your experience. And I got into it, and yeah, but let's first introduce Corey. So Corey, maybe you could tell us a little bit about. So we know Run CRS, you know a lot of races they do. Sporting Life is another huge race that everybody knows about, the Toronto Women's Series. Kind of, can you tell us a little bit about your background and Max Viel too?
Sure. I started, I was not put in front of a stack of shoes for sales while in diapers, but I have been in the business for a long time. I started, actually, my first forte into the race directing world was I was working at the YMCA. At Metro Central YMCA in downtown Toronto. I'm a phys ed grad, and one of my first jobs in the business was a part-time summer job at the Y in the phys ed department. And I was a runner and a triathlete at the time, and I still am. And they had this really cool race called the YMCA Corporate Team Challenge. And that was where teams of four people would go on and run a 5K loop together. And they sort of said, well, you're a runner. Why don't you just manage the event? And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, that would be fun. And that's kind of how I got thrown into it. And that was probably about 1990. And I did that for about 12 to 14 years. And then I left the Y. And I went and worked at a couple other national health organizations managing their large national events, including Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation's Run for the Cure and Canadian Diabetes Team Diabetes Canada. From there, I'd always seen the women's running scene was sort of evolving in about 2008, and Oprah had done her marathon, and there was like a big running boom going on. And I'm like, you know, this women's running thing is really cool. And I was, as a woman, doing these races. I'm like, this feels really special. So I decided, you know what, I'm gonna launch these races. And I sort of quit my job, steady full-time gig, and became a race director. I had no idea sort of how it's going to work. I worked at Canada Running Series for a while as well. And then I launched the Women's Running Series in 2009. And we're now going into our 13th year. Along the way, I started as Max VO2. And along the way, I added some more properties, including the Sporting Life 10K. And I started being the race director of that in 2014. And we started off with 25,000 people running down Yonge Street. And as a native Torontonian, I knew what the Sporting Life 10K was, and I knew how cool and exciting it was and what a wonderful cause it is of raising money for Camp Ooch. So that's kind of how I got my foray into it. And here we are, 2021, still doing, working hard at it. And it's funny, it's a small world of race directors in the running community. So none of us really go too far at the end of the day or stray far from our respective areas.
Yeah, and that speaks to a couple of things that maybe you all identify, but there's two female race director at the top of their game. It's like, that's something to be checked off the box there. And with the experience, decades of experience from being a toddler growing up in the business, I'm sure it might have been from the approach where it's as simple as, you know, your dad needed to get fitter. And then now years later from that one thing that stemmed there. But there's a couple of things that have made it so much more interesting to hear from you both, because you're both identified as a female race directors. And just speaking of the different race experiences or organizational experience that you come with, it shows up in the actual events at the end of the day.
Yeah, we didn't actually plan that to have two women race directors, but it actually worked out really well. And that's come up in conversation, I believe, Dre, we've had in the past about just kind of women in sport and kind of success and what's happening in this space. But yeah, this is great. It's worked out really well.
It's a unique thing in Canada, actually. Most of the major races in Canada are female-led. So something that we don't see so much with our neighbors down south, and it's a very cool thing. Across again, Calgary and Manitoba and out east and Blue Nose. And yeah, lots of female leadership in the race director world.
Because I also believe that there is this part of it where there will be parts and bits that you make it so that it includes all genders. An example would have been, you know, how many washrooms are along the course, that type of stuff. You know, how from your perspective, being in a race as a participant, what would make sense for you compared to a male, right? So there are different requirements that you'd have, you know, make sure it is available compared to if I put it together and not know certain nuances, right? So it speaks to itself.
Well, Dre, that's actually really funny, because there's a story about the New York City Marathon, and they put all the men on the bridge for the start. And that was the only year they did that. I'm sure the race director was male at the time, because all the men peed over the bridge onto the women underneath.
That don't even make sense. Like, wow.
Awful.
So it's funny, Charlotte, because those stories are, and I've run New York City three times, are the stories like, nah, that never really happened. I don't believe it. But here we have like corroborating, like evidence, like proof that it actually does happen.
Uh-oh, you're going to hold me to this now, aren't you?
No, we don't need to see video, but yeah, it's okay. We believe it happens.
No, but I believe also just like other bits where, you know, it could be the t-shirt size, like little bits like that we would never considered, right?
I remember years and years ago, there again around t-shirt sizing and just, you know, what if the male shirt fits me better? And we're having all these conversations around how, you know, to communicate that the shirts, you can pick whatever shirt fits you best, right? And this again, like Corey, I feel like this was 20 years ago. I was having these conversations at Packet Pickup, being like, oh, you want this, the men's medium that fits you? That's great. Take whatever fits you best. Don't worry about the, you know, the gender in front of it. But
and it's funny because I have a women's race series. And so the thing, you know, those two topics, you know, the porta potties, there's a different ratio for women than men because it takes us longer. And so when I started the race series, I knew that my ratio or my number of porta potties was going to be double what we had always had, because traditionally the running scene was predominantly male dominated. And until really about, you know, 19, the late 90s, when we really sort of had this next running boom, or early 2000s, you know, you would line up for a race and it was mostly men. And, you know, there were some women, but over time, and especially, I really believe, I call this sort of the Oprah effect, because she really sort of broke down the barriers for women being comfortable to go out and just jog or run. And it really sort of leveled the playing field. And then what happened from there was the emergence of the women's running races, of women-only kind of races, but also within the rest of the industry, you know, it started to slowly change. So they were like, okay, a lot more women are running together, and women's running groups became more popular because it's a social thing for women, more so than a competitive thing that the men traditionally sort of, you know, make it a bit more competitive. But women, for them, it's let's train together. It's a group of people, and then they'll go to an event. Maybe it's a travel destination or it's just a local race, but there'll be a group of 5 or 10 women. And so as all of this was sort of happening concurrently, the idea of a race that didn't offer a t-shirt size of both genders, it became like, no, that doesn't work anymore. And for me as a women's series, of course, I was, you know, these are women's size shirts. And at the beginning, that was a huge thing, a huge draw. And now, a big differentiator, now it's not. It's just a norm. And the same, you know, with the porta potties, you know, you think about, there's like no men's bathrooms, women's bathrooms. It's just generic. And now you sort of have to do the math a little bit differently, knowing that a lot of the time, 60% of your participants are female. And so you as the race director, we have to take that into account. And what we actually do at our races, because, you know, women like those extra touches, like we used to have people directing the runners into an open porta potty so that, again, to sort of make it a bit more of an inviting environment, we, you know, we have volunteers doing all sorts of non-traditional roles that really made it different. And even the idea of tampons available in the porta potties on race day, or going to an info tent of, you know, just saying, do you know, are there any available, and not even having any issue with asking or receiving. And I think those were sort of how things started to evolve and to where we're at now, where a lot of these things are just the norm. It's just a given. And we're continuing to break down those gender norms or barriers.
Yeah, I don't want to, Corey, thank you for kind of walking us through that. I don't want to dwell on porta potties, but I do have one specific question about this. And I did a race 2 years ago in the GTA area. I won't say the race or where it was, because we just don't want to, you know, it's not about that. But there was a shortage or just a lack of porta potties. Now, guys, like, they don't even think about it. It's like, okay, I'll just go here and it's done, right? But like women just don't have, well, first of all, men shouldn't do that anyway, but women don't have that option a lot of times. It's just not, it just doesn't work, right? So, you know, I think it's like, we were going through the race and I was actually saying to people, because even I was thinking like, I really have to go. But my thing was, there's so many people around me. I didn't want to just be that guy that just like dips in somewhere, right? So that's an interesting thing. And I kind of wonder how much thought actually goes into this, or maybe should go into this when you're thinking about races. It could be a 5K, it could be a half, full, whatever. But I sometimes wonder if enough thought goes into these things.
It's a very important thing.
I feel like every race director conference we have, we talk about the ratio, right?
Yeah.
There's never enough portalettes, because the nature, the nature of it all is that most people get nervous before they're about to run in a race, and they get nervous right before. So we have 25,000 people lining up for the start of a race. You need to get in there, you know, half an hour before the start. How many of those people are going to need to use a toilet, you know, 10 minutes before start time? What does that look like? And again, for like the Scotiabank Toronto Waterfront Marathon, it's real estate. Yeah. It's not budget, right? So we're trying to find every corner of a street where we can throw some porta potties that's like accessible for people. So for the most part, most race directors want to give you more toilets, but it's usually a space issue.
Yeah.
I would argue, right, Corey? Like sometimes it can be budgetary, but most of the time it's a space issue and the fact that people need to
absolutely
use them right before.
Like you can never have enough. I mean, and there's people who specialize in finding the spaces along the most convenient areas near your start line of where you can load as many in, and doing the measurements of like, okay, well, I think in this little area we could get 5, and over there there's another 7, and so it becomes quite a chess game, and it all of us are take it very seriously, because as Charlotte said, like, everybody has to go all at the same time. So it is definitely a big concern. And our runners tell us, they provide us the feedback, whether or not they thought there were enough or not.
Yeah. And I never even put those things together, because obviously when you're in the experience, you'll find every other reason to say that's missing, but it's impossible to have everyone use the toilet at the same time, regardless of, there will be a line regardless, but to be able to identify that this is an important bit is good enough. And also there are only a subset of new runners that may not have experienced what it is at a start line. You know, other experienced runners would have known their way they'd go about, relieving themselves prior, or just not, have coffee before they run kind of scenario because of that nervous feel. I also noticed that because of these components, it almost has to be like a build your own race experience Elocart, because in reality, someone could be identified differently, but also I wear this type of clothing and I use this washroom. So it's you trying to cater for each of these components. And then now, and people have been identifying as different pronouns as well, and their gender identity. So I can imagine how flexible you still have to be able to accommodate all those facets.
And at least with porta potties, again, like Corey said earlier, there's no gender, right? It's they're portable toilets. The other factor, I guess, that we didn't really touch on is the accessible toilets. We have to consider, like, there are accessible portalettes that we have at all of our events, and where are we placing them? We have really unique venues like the zoo, the Toronto Zoo, and our post-race area has a lot of grass and hills and, so where we place other toilets and making sure our signage is really clear so our accessible toilet is in the right spot as well for people to use should they need to.
I feel like we could do a whole podcast on porta potties.
No, it all connects. It all connects.
It does connect. But I do want to stay on this topic for a little bit, Corey, of women in racing and the work that you're doing with your event. How prevalent is this outside of Toronto, Canada, maybe? Do you see this a lot?
Women's races they're definitely common. They're all around the world, and you don't have to look super hard to find a women's race. They're not women only, because obviously men are welcome. For myself, I always encourage men to participate. One of we raise money for a charitable organization called POGO, which is Pediatric Oncology Group of Ontario. And there's a lot of parents or families whose kids are sick or have benefited from the work of POGO. And so we get a lot of dads and brothers and family members who want to be a part of the day. And so it's important that everybody feels welcome. Yes, it's a women's race. And yes, let's say 95% of our participants are female, but are women. But at the end of the day, men are welcome. Absolutely. We're raising money for a great cause. We want everybody to feel included. One year we've had like a bride to be and her fiance running together. Like people have really made the most of it. Brothers and sisters run. We have a lot of young kids, so they're in it together. A lot of the times, like, my niece and nephew will run, and my brother was trying to run with them, and they're like, no, dad, just don't do that. You're holding us back. You're holding us back, kind of thing. So yes, they are very common. As I said, when I started the race series, I was pretty much one of the only women's races series around in the country. That's no longer the case. They're far more common. And when I started the race series, there was already this very, very well-known race in New York called the Bonnie Bell 10K. And then it got a different sponsor. It was Legs, which was at the time a pantyhose manufacturer. And it was a 10K that was in Central Park, very, very, very competitive. And then they opened it up to as many women as possible. And it was getting 50,000 women. It was great. And to see the traction of these races around the world in different countries was one of the inspirations for me to say, okay, Toronto's a great city. We can have a women's race here. We did have one before I started my series. It was down on the lakeshore. It was for a couple of years. But again, it took a little bit of time for the concept to really become entrenched in the offerings within the endurance world. And I mean, it's become such a great thing that there's women triathlon, there's women bike races. So it's not just unique to running. I think in the entire endurance industry, we have a lot of specific women races. And there's a different feel to them. There's definitely, it's supportive. I mean, Charlotte, you've done a lot of my races. You know what it feels like. It's really different. It's fun. The women are supportive. There's camaraderie. I get some of the best elite athletes, women coming out, and they're fast, and they're taking it seriously as a mixed gender race. So it is definitely open to all. And at the same time, you can make it as fun or as competitive as you want. And that's what really makes it great.
I do your race with my mother every year, Corey. It's a lot of fun.
And my mom does my races too, you know, so that's the really nice thing. And we've had people come to the races who've never run before. And I think this is important, especially as like we're in COVID, and when we come out, we're going to have all these new racers. And they come to these races and they're really scared. Like, we've all done races and maybe we're a bit jaded about, you know, what to do, but we've had people come up or even at Kit Pickup and they're like, you give them the bib and they're like, well, what do I do with this? Like, do I hold it? What do I do? And we're like, no, you pin it on you. And they're like, well, what do you mean? And we're like, well, we have these safety pins and you pin it. Oh, and you explain the timing chip to it. And even where to stand in a race, how to line up in the corral. It's really neat to see that. And, you know, this is the cool thing about running. The cool thing about our sport is it's the only sport, I think, where you can really stand in the start line with probably the people who are going to win. It's the only sport where you can rub elbows with the winner. And that's what makes it really, really exciting and fun, that there's not a lot of sports where, you know, you're lining up with, you know, the person who's going to win.
Mm-hmm. Or even just being along the same route.
Yeah.
They're just going to be a few legs in front of you.
Yeah.
I remember one year, just a quick story. I was in the Ottawa race with Justin Trudeau, and he was right in front of us. So me and my buddy were like, we're going to tag onto him and go. And he just took off. We were like trying to get photo off, like, let's go. But it was. So when people run, they run. It was the funniest thing ever. But my buddy got a photo. I was trying to be all like, no.
Yeah.
So I also believe that at the end of the day, regardless of how the race is curated, it's about the charity, right?
Yeah.
So that's the end result. And that would lead me to a question where how that come about. So you could be a race organizer and get excited about the event itself and the logistics and trying to be excited about that. But how do you select the type of charity that requires this type of stuff? Like, how's that process like formulated?
I guess it depends on the race. So for us, at least at the Scotiabank Toronto Waterfront Marathon and our Montreal half and our Vancouver half, we have a charity challenge. And so that concept actually came years and years ago out of the London Marathon. So they are the number one world's biggest fundraising event. You know, how many millions of pounds do they raise? I think it's 10.
Did they hit a billion? 100 million pounds? I thought they hit a billion.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's just, these numbers are huge. And so we brought that back to Toronto and said, you know, what can we do to make an impact to the community and support smaller charity groups at our event? Again, so they don't need to put on their own fun run. They can come to the Scotiabank Toronto Waterfront Marathon, bring all their fundraisers, not worried about the toilets and the cones and all those things, and actually get to spend their energy on raising funds for their important cause. So, you know, again, in the pandemic last year, with Toronto Waterfront, we raised $2.96 million for 150 charities. So that was huge. And, and again, percentage-wise, we usually hit 3.5. So just a huge accomplishment in the pandemic when those charities needed it, you know, more than ever.
Corey, I believe that answer is probably for Sporting Life is easy, right?
You know, and that's the interesting thing. So Charlotte's sort of on the, you know, Charlotte's got the charity challenge and they're raising a lot of money for many, many charities. And it's great. It's so impactful. Sporting Life, it's different, as in there's one charitable partner, and that's Camp Ooch. And that money goes to help. It sends kids who are living with cancer to camp and to different in-hospital programs. And it's a very easy story to tell. And for a lot of people, that makes it easier for them to fundraise and to support the cause. And similar to Charlotte, and I think all of us in the business have seen this amazing phenomenon happened, that in COVID, we are raising more money than before. In our in-person races, you know, normally that's Sporting Life would raise over $2 million. And then last year when we had to go virtual, at the end of the day, we raised over $1.2 million. And we had, you know, less than half of the people participate. This year, we're in Sporting Life right now, and we've almost raised $1 million. And, you know, this year we did not, you know, we've had maybe about 5,000 people sign up. So the people who are participating want to be involved. They want to give back. They want to donate, and they also want to fundraise. And that's what I'm seeing in my women's series is I raised more money last year during COVID than I did in my in-person event. So I really think that just bodes well, and it says a lot for all of us in a time where we don't have a lot of control over what, you know, our lives or what we can do. What the one thing we can do is give back and make a difference to others. And I think that's why all of us saw such a really significant uptake. And that was just so, it was so nice for all, well, I can only speak for myself, for me to see the community get together at such a strange time when we're running virtually, but yet at the same time, everybody's like, this is more important than ever, and I am going to make an impact and make a difference.
Yeah, I love the fact that the messaging still comes across, regardless of it being virtual, and we don't have those visual cues of a crowd to be able to, you know, quantitatively show that it's a successful event, because the success is how well the charity component is. And with the different approaches, I believe obviously Camp Portuguese, you can actually curate the experience because we have an end result with that. I'm sure, Charlotte, it might be challenging to then do the charity challenge and then try to think of here are the different benefits, regardless of it's just having a template. I could imagine you have to make sure it is a legitimate charity, because obviously there's some bad actors out there as well too, right? And just on the bad actor part of it, I also believe even more so than ever, some of us realize the things that we were worried about is no longer a thing anymore. Yeah. So it with the pandemic as is, some people I'm sure they signed up for the virtual and they just wanted to sign up to donate without actually running it. So it's interesting to hear the real numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
We've been speaking a little bit about pandemic. I do feel like we can get into all the nitty gritty of racing, and this we could be talking for a while. We may have to have you back and get on kind of day in the life of like race director and stuff like that, because there's so much that goes into it and it's so fascinating. If it's okay, maybe we can shift the conversation a little bit, because there's a lot of things happening in the news right now, Boston, New York, et cetera, which is all incredibly exciting. I know Toronto's a different world, different story, but still, maybe we could start with, before we get into like the excitement of what's happening, not to like drag us down, but maybe you could tell us about how, as race directors, you had to be kind of creative the last 2 years or so. I know, you know, virtual racing, keeping people motivated to do those kind of things. I will say that between, you know, yourself, Corey, and Charlotte, we've seen some amazing things happening in the virtual space in Toronto, especially in your two camps. So maybe Charlotte, if we could start with you, you could just tell us like, what has the last year plus been like for you?
Yeah, I guess maybe to Dre's point, you know, we're not caring about the same things or holding on to maybe some things that we used to think were focuses. As they once were. We really had to look at everything, look at as a company, you know, what do we want to do? What is our mission? What did we set out, you know, what did Alan set out to do 30 years ago when he had me in diapers trying to sell shoes at a race? And it was to build community through running. That's our mission, right? So when the pandemic hit, and, you know, we started the pandemic off with refunds and making sure that we supported our community and provided them with what we could do, right? So giving them the option for refunds for entries, then, you know, take a step further and say, well, what are we going to do in this virtual space? And, you know, for Corey and so many people, we've been talking about virtual for a while. This wasn't a brand new thing that the pandemic brought us. It's something that other races have been doing for a while. And I had a meeting with the running room in January, and we were really excited for 2020. We were going to bring virtual to SDWM. And we were going to get all the running rooms across the country going. And so for people that can't fly into Toronto, we wanted to make the experience more accessible. So across the country, you can still feel like you're part of it. We'll send your bib, your medal, your shirt, and you do it from there. And of course, the pandemic hit in March. So it just kind of sped up our our journey into virtual. And, you know, the big pile, right? Everyone had a pile before the pandemic and got to bring that pile over and really look at it and see what we could prioritize. So with virtual for us, it was twofold and very similar to Corey. We wanted to be innovative and creative with the virtual space. So, you know, creating new virtual experiences. You know, I'm wearing my TTC shirt right now. I know no one can see on the podcast, but that was a really cool, fun thing for our team to work on. We had a great relationship with the TTC. I was on a Zoom call with Run to Beer, and somebody out of New York was like, oh, New York's doing the subway thing. Like, you should do it in Toronto. And I was like, oh, wait a second. That's pretty cool. Let me call up our TTC contact, who is the wife of one of our zone directors at the marathon, and see what she thinks. And within a couple of weeks, it all came together. It was pretty cool. And that for me, even, you know, again, as a runner, I ran the entire subway line, right? I went from Kipling to Kennedy Station to everything within that period. And you felt a connection to something in person again in that way. Like, I visited every single subway station. I got to re-explore the city of Toronto. I have never gone out to Vaughan Station, nor to Vaughan. I don't think I've ever stopped in Vaughan. So running by there and going by Highway 7 and all that stuff, it was just a different way to approach virtual. I think that was really cool and kind of gave you a little bit of that in-person connection without being able to come together again.
And for you, Corey?
I'm similar to Charlotte. We had already started to think about, okay, we're going to start adding a virtual option, and then COVID happened. So it made us do it a bit faster, which is a good thing. So similar scenario. When we had to convert to virtual, we did so. We had to deal with the refunds and the deferrals and everything. And it was interesting to see that people still wanted, you know, for some people, they were open to it. And then in the summer, I was like, we realized at the beginning, you know, you're thinking, oh, maybe it'll be okay in the fall. Maybe we'll get out of this real quickly. It'll be okay. And then, you know, it's like, that's so not going to happen. And so in the summer, I started to think, I was like, okay, I need to keep my people engaged. And I have three races in my series, but I knew I needed to do something a little bit different. So I created something called the 416 Run Challenge. And that was for people to run 416 kilometers. And we had a map, an interactive map, and you would plot your distance and it would show you working through the route. And it was really cool. And what we did was we created these welcome kits. And so you would sign up for the event and we would send you a mug, which I don't have on me, but we did coffee. We did co-branded coffee with Pilot Coffee. So we were called Women Run Toronto. And so we did a co-branded bean. You got little charms every 150 kilometers. So you had something to motivate you. So in the welcome kit, you got your mug and your coffee and a necklace. And it said, every time you do 150K, we're going to mail you one of your charms, because it's spelled R-U-N. And on the back was a 416. And so the more you went through the challenge, you would get your charm. So we knew that was a huge motivator and people were really engaged. We raised money for Pogo. We raised money for Second Harvest and another organization called Sistering. And it was in September. And I think this really had something to do with it, is I knew people needed something to do when the weather changed. Like, we had come out of COVID. It was summer. It was like all okay. And then all of a sudden it was like, uh-oh, winter's coming. We have no real races to keep us motivated. I'm like, I got to find out a big enough challenge to keep everyone going. So I launched 416 and it took off. It was really popular. But then what happened was they started doing it really quickly. And people were like, I'm so bored. I've got nothing to do. I'm going to do this quickly. And the woman who won, came in first, she was like walking 35, 40 kilometers a day. And I a couple of times I had to phone her because I thought, okay, that's a lot of walking. And I would phone her. I'm like, hi, I just want to make sure, like, you know, you're really walking a lot. She goes, you don't understand. I am a legal secretary. My office is closed. I'm bored and I don't like winter. So I'm going to make sure I get this done before it snows. So I'm like, okay, whatever it takes. So people were really into it. And then I realized that they were going to be done early. So I had to figure out point two, you know, 2.0. So I created 416 Run Challenge Gold, where they did it all again, another 416K to keep them over the winter. And they loved it. And so you had to, what you had to do was finish your first one to get access to sign up for the gold. And so they did that all in the spring. So that's been really popular. And all the other stuff has been going really well. And then I started a woof walk challenge where people and their dogs can walk that I started last month. Because again, we're bored. We have nowhere to go. You might as well walk with your dog. So I've offered that in addition to all the regular virtual runs. So it's one of those things where I think people were just looking for, we're looking for things to do, right, guys? Like,
yeah.
What about the person who ran every street in Toronto? That guy was cool, you know?
Oh, I just saw that.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah.
That was amazing. And I just want to say that, you know, Corey and you know, others, you have been keeping Richard really busy. So at certain point, he's going to have to start paying us for all these mentions on his podcast, because we just had Pride Run on and we talked about Richard. And Richard is, first of all, he's a gem and an absolute asset to the running community. Like, his creativity is boundless. And I just love the calendar for the 416 and the gems and all that stuff. So, and even the woof walk and all that stuff. So, you're all keeping him busy. But a serious comment real quick. I love that. Yes, there's a pandemic going on, and, you know, hopefully for not much longer. And yeah, it's really wreaking havoc on race directors around the world. But you're still tapping into creativity and thinking about other ways to keep people motivated and the community engaged. Love, love, love that so, so much, because it's so difficult, because people are just thinking, what in the world am I going to do? But you're giving them something to do. So thank you.
Yeah, it's been fun. That's been part of the most fun about this time. Like, it's been really hard, obviously, and for us especially. We're going to be the last ones who are going to get back to work, so to speak. But for us to be able to just be this creative, like the TTC challenge that CRS did, like, that was super cool. And just all of us being able to just try something different and to see people are so open to it. And that's also reassuring.
Yep, for sure.
I can't tell you how many positive comments at curbside pickup I got from people with the TTC challenge, just saying, you gave me a reason to leave my place. Yeah. Like, thank you. Because ours was November, December. So similar to what you said, Corey, right? Like, it was getting to the dark days of winter and people were really like getting nervous about what that was going to look like. So this kind of provided them with something each day to kind of, you know, like you said, with the 416 challenge, tick off and focus on and feel good about themselves and accomplishing something. So yeah, it was a really nice experience.
Everyone wanted something to look forward to, and you've provided that, even a smaller form factor. But it was as effective as you'd think it would have been unsuccessful, because with the refunds and deferrals and stuff like that, that could have had you all on like just a stasis mode to kind of like just to see what happens without even putting out an actual race or just a challenge for individuals and provide, you know, with the trinkets. My buddy saw those and he's like, oh, I want trinkets. So it was this reward system that you've implemented in that. I did run the TTC one as well with the Everyday Fit guys with the other group. And then we all did a piece of it, but just something to look forward to, like having a day to do a thing. The other benefit of virtual, you mentioned yourself, Charlotte, is that I could be in a different country and I wanted to run Scotia. And that just allowed me to be able to participate without even physically flying. And the other bit is like for someone that wants to make some, you know, a splash, they want to go fast or anything of the sort, they can choose what date is perfect. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, the weather is nice today. I could just go. You couldn't do that in a real race. You can't choose a time. You can't choose anything. And usually it's based on obviously closing down a street and having a date to book all the vendors. And those are the benefits outside of the other bit, the major races that you do host, and the fact that you are all so flexible to adapt to a smaller like crit, I call it made it that much more exciting. And I'm sure you're going to adapt some of these smaller things into the much bigger races, right?
Yeah. I feel like, you know, even going back to the innovation and that component of it, again, Corey talked about how she got into this and I mentioned Alan and then me and diapers and whatnot, but Alan used to say all the time, he's a runner in business. He's not a business person into running. right? We're all so passionate about what we do. So when this pandemic hit, like the creative stuff is like, what do I want? Like, what do I need right now? And like, you know, talking to other people in the community and like, what are you looking for? Like, how can I, you know, provide you with something that you're not getting in a safe way? and you know, that type of thing. So I think a lot of it stems from our passion and love for what we do, for sure.
And I think for me, it's exactly that. When I started the women's races, it was like, is this something I would do? Because I'm a runner, I'm passionate about running. I'm like, is this something I would do? And I'm like, yeah, I would do it. And then I'm like, okay, if I would do it, then I think other people are going to do it. I think it's cool. I think it's going to work. And that's exactly what I've sort of done with the challenge as well with the 416. I'm like, okay, this would work for me. It would keep me going, especially in the winter when I'm so don't want to do it. And it did. And every day you're like, okay, I got to go. I can do my mileage. And it's the same idea, because you wouldn't go to Vaughn probably and run 10K, but it's just that. It's like, it's sort of that fun factor.
I do want to ask a question, and I'm not, you know, you don't have to give away your trade secrets. I know Charlotte, probably all eyes are on Scotia right now and kind of October coming up and kind of what's happening in Toronto. We don't have to answer directly, but if you see what's happening in Boston and kind of New York City, and I'm sure Chicago's not going to be too far behind and other races, what would it take to go from virtual to back to live? Is there a cutoff? You don't have to give us exact dates, I know, but is there something like, hey, this is probably the latest we could go, everything set up? Because I know there's like the city and planning. And don't want to shut down Active TR. I'm just kidding. But like all that
stuff, part. Yeah.
but it's another wrinkle, right? But like of all the things you think about, like it, like even for you, probably after maybe Charlotte answers, but what does it take to get back into life?
Yeah, sure. I guess I can say, you know, a few weeks ago we went on Facebook Live. Like, we're all about just giving the straight goods, being honest, like, what do you want to know? And so we did kind of a tell all, and what I shared there was there's so many factors that we have to consider, right? So with this pandemic, we know our frontline workers, healthcare, like nurses, doctors, they're all burnt out. They're exhausted, you know, and for the marathon, we have 100 volunteers in the medical tent. We have doctors, nurses, like these are the things we need to keep people safe.
Yeah.
So, you know, what does that look like? All these businesses that have been hit so hard through this pandemic, are we going to close the roads down and further impact them for this one day, right? Our race is on Bloor Street. It's on Bathurst. It's, you think of the restaurants, think of the hair salons that, you know, maybe they finally get to open again. What does that look like if we're doing those things? And then outside of that, you know, working with the city. So we've been having some calls, and Corey's looped in with all these calls with the city to just see how they're doing, right? What are they up to? Have they all been moved into different roles? This is what we knew. And that's just been really confirmed in the last couple of weeks that they have been displaced into other roles. I have a good friend at the Office of Emergency Management. He helps us out big time with the marathon every year. And I've been able to do some great work with him. And he's on the immunization task force and hasn't met about an event since before March of last year, right? So what does everything look like when we want to get back to in-person racing? And so again, around that date for us, we're runners. We really want to do something in person. You know, we do what we do because we love seeing people accomplish pretty cool things, right? And so we're willing to maybe push the timeline a little tighter if it means we can do something and we can do something safely and whatnot. So, you know, normally it's a year round biz, right? We're planning the marathon October 20th, the year before, and we start our conversations with the city, you know, at least 10 months out. So I was talking to them last week and I said, July 13th is our date. That's when it's 3 months out. That's the cutoff. So for us, we're really hoping to have a very clear picture of how the vaccine rollout is going. Are we going to have one vaccine in everyone, two vaccines? What's that? Is it going to be one, you know, 100 people are allowed to gather in person by October? You know, are we going to put on a Scotiabank Toronto Waterfront Marathon with 100 people? No. Right. So those are just the stuff we're looking at. But mid-July is when we're going to decide and let everyone know where we're at with that. And then for virtual, we launch tomorrow. So again, we spoke about our charity partners and we already have 60 charities signed up and they're rearing to go and get their fundraising. So we wanted to open up virtual for people earlier than that July date. So that launches tomorrow. And then we'll work towards that July date for in-person with the city and just see what's realistic and safe and possible, if anything, this year.
No, I'm happy you're able to, as an organization, read the room, right? You could have just based it on just what is happening internally there and not taking into other factors that JG and I were just surprised about, you know, with surrounding businesses shutting down streets and stuff like that. And the optics as well. So yeah, we're both in a race, but someone that's not privy of the fact that the numbers has changed for the positive, they wouldn't actually equate that to you should host a race. So there's so much misinformation going on around. So it just reading the room helps a lot.
Yeah, and we work with the stakeholders again year round, right? We do everything we can to provide them with a great race day experience. You know, we have all the cheer sites out and community groups around. How have they been affected by the pandemic? All those things like we just talked about. So absolutely, we're having those conversations with them when making the decision.
Corey, your race is, well, I know Sporting Life is May, but then the women's race series is also just passed, right? So you would already be thinking about 2022 anyway, right?
Well, actually Sporting Life happens on Mother's Day. So that was virtual this year. My May half marathon virtually kicks off Sunday. I have an August race, a 10K, 5K, that's virtual. And my last race is an 8K, 5K in the women's series. And that is the week after STWM. So I'm like, Charlotte, we'll wait and see what happens. We need to know what's safe, what's doable, and then we'll go. I mean, my women's series in the Sunnybrook Park is much smaller. So I'm able to kind of potentially make it happen a bit more easily than Charlotte is. I don't have to deal with as many stakeholders. But at the end of the day, we really are looking for guidance from our province, our local health providers, public health, our city staff. And so we have to wait on them to, you know, to be able to have a sense of what it could look like if we are able to come together later in this year.
They give us the permits. So they're going to say yes, ultimately decide whether or not we get to do anything. Yeah.
I love the fact that the different organizations do work together to have a clear picture right across the board. That's something that we may not be privy of. And it might be a misconception that, you know, race directors don't communicate about races. And we're seeing that right now that you do and have the same conversations because you do go through similar processes in order to put out a successful race.
Yeah, I think again, like Canada, our race director community is so tight. We have a Zoom call once a month with the races across the country, like all the big races, just to support each other. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing to like set up your reg form? What does this look like? And we just, you know, take an hour out of our day, and it's great to have that ability. Yeah, like you said, like we're all not in the same boat, but we speak a similar language, and so we like to come together and be able to kind of see what everyone's up to and where we can support and stuff.
And you did mention our race form, and I think JG would have some questions regarding inclusivity. And we've had a conversation with the Pride and Remembrance Run organization and their approach to race forms.
So we covered, racing, we covered pandemic. Another topic that's been coming up quite a bit, and we spoke with Rich McBride about this, and we spoke with Chris and Gabriel from Pride Run, is inclusivity in racing. So there's another big topic that's been coming up a lot. And we know, because we've heard from quite a few people, that we know, Corey, that you're doing a lot of work in this space. And we know that Canada Running Series is doing a ton of work in this space about inclusivity. You know, we know how important it is in this day and age. So maybe, Corey, if we could maybe start with you on kind of the registration process. I know prizing is a topic that comes up a lot. So I'm just kind of wondering, what are your thoughts around this?
It's a great question. So I think to give a bit more context, in 2019, as you know, we do talk amongst each other, our fellow race directors. So in 2019, Charlotte and I began to have a conversation around registration forms and the question of gender, because traditionally we had come from registration forms that, you know, it wasn't even gender, it was sex, male, female. And over time, we also recognized as things were changing that we weren't serving our community as well as we could. And we needed to revisit the whole concept of what questions were we going to ask in the registration flow? And after sort of coming together and saying, you know, this male-female doesn't work, we really need to look at gender. And again, being in Toronto, it's even more important. What should we be asking? What is important? What do we really need to know? And I have a women's race series. So right off the bat, I think that it opened some more doors as to what are the right gender questions. I'm gay. I'm out. I want to feel included when I check. I look at a reg form. What are they asking? And so we decided that, you know what, we need to broaden our scope of who's going to help us with this, because we knew that we needed to bring in the different members of the community. So we put together a working group. So Canada Running Series, we're definitely spearheading it. It was myself. We had someone from our registration company in the group. And then we went out to the 519. I had some friends who worked at the 519 and had some contacts. And we said, we need your help. We want to make, we're going to start with Toronto and we're going to start with the bigger races and say, we can do a better job on our gender questions. What should we be asking? And we sat with the 519 different staff, education staff, different people. And they said, okay, here's what we think would be a good place to start. And that was to move from the sex question to gender and to say under gender, man, woman, non-binary, or prefer not to disclose. And they said, this would be a good place to start. And then we said, well, you know, pride has a lot more categories. Maybe, you know, maybe we should do that. And then, you know, it's sort of like, well, the pride run, that makes probably more sense to ask that many different questions in our races. Where do we start to learn more? So we started with those four categories. And the most interesting part was someone from the 519 who worked there, they're an athlete. And we said, what do you think of this? And this prefer not to disclose. It sounds kind of, I don't know, could we do better with the wording? And they said, no, start there because you just don't know what you don't know. And those people who don't feel included in these four categories, and I hate to use that word category, they'll reach out and tell you. They'll tell you if you're doing the right job or where maybe we should change the wording. And so that's how we started. And so we did that in 2019, and we had, you know what, a lot of people, like in sporting life, it's a big race, so that would be a good example. You know, I had over 100 people select prefer not to disclose, and about 50 people were non-binary. And in the women's series, you can scale it down. And then COVID happened. And still those gender options exist. And they're still, you know, those percentages are still reflective when we look at the breakdown of participants. And I think, well, and I can't speak for Canada Running Series, but we did something huge in terms of beginning to change the gender recognition in the endurance world in Canada, because now all the larger races or most of the races now have adopted this. And I think, you know, in Canada, maybe we're a bit more progressive. Now, most races ask this, it's a norm. And yet in the States, it's funny, you can still see some of the registration forms, it's like sex, male, female. I'm like, really? And yet, I mean, did everyone here on the call do the census? You see those gender questions? Assigned sex at birth, how do you identify? I mean, really, for the Canadian census to do that, that made me feel good because it's like, we're on the right path here. And here's an industry who's doing this. So we're not going back. And I think if anything, we'll continue to evolve it. And we need our participants to help us because we can't do a better job unless we know how to do that and who else would like. How can we make everyone feel included?
I feel like you touched on a few things, and maybe even with virtual, I know with Pride, like they dropped the gender off the form, right? For virtual. And I wonder again, like, you know, with us, for some of our challenges, gender and age are not included in the results, right? Because it's really just about you knocking down those kilometers, right? It doesn't matter if you run or walk. It doesn't matter what your time is. Like the TTC challenge, you had to finish 76 kilometers, right? That was the goal. So when, you know, those are some of the things that we're thinking about now and have implemented through virtual is, you know, what is the virtual race? What's the goal? What is everyone trying to accomplish? And does gender and age play into that? When you go into some of our traditional races, like the Spring Runoff or the Scotiabank Toronto Waterfront Marathon, you know, a lot of people are still, you know, they're competing in this age gender piece. So even in virtual, I can't even tell you how many conversations we've had around that piece, because it's not something we control, right? It's all honor system. You go in, you put your 5K time in, like thumbs up, you're good to go. But some people are writing in being like, I'm going to dispute that person's time and this and that. And like, I want to see where I stack in that, you know, gender age group. And you're like, it's virtual, just relax. Everyone's just, you know, getting out and doing stuff. But yeah, so there is a balance, I think, between our events and the types of events. But we are looking at all those things to say, you know, why do we need to ask the question, where does it show up? And what purpose does it serve? And so for those other races, it really, for the most part, that age category piece was a conversation, you know, Corey, we had with the 519 as well. And some people, even to your point earlier, Dre, about what we like focus on and what we care about, people aren't out there to be sneaky and malicious. That's not people's end goal. They're not picking a category just to get the third place medal in the 35 to 39 prefer not to disclose category. Like, to avoid asking or changing the gender options in the forum only because of your concern of how it's being used. It's just, that was a non-starter for Corey and like our team and stuff. Like, we weren't concerned with that piece of it. And I know that that can be a roadblock for some people when making that leap.
Yeah, and it makes sense because there is such a thing as the gender fluidity. So they would, based on that particular time, how they feel at that moment or they identify. So not having it is to not saying you're tone deaf. It's to not categorize the same individual, right? So that helps. And then it will always be changing, especially now. So kudos for taking it on and leading it. This wasn't a question from us to say you should do it. You've been doing it. So that's just like a kudos from anyone here that brought it up. And Jonathan and I had learned a lot from Rach McBride. They explained what it meant, and they had so much emotion in just, and it was a big different conversation. So the educational piece of it is what makes us comprehend. But if you don't spend the time to do that, then you already count yourself out.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to that interview you guys did with Rach.
Oh, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
It's like, you had to study your piece before you came on, right?
Totally.
That's so funny.
Nah, that was good.
It was a great interview. And what I thought was so, I mean, ironic or whatever, is that they identify as non-binary, yet for their profession and for their rankings and to qualify for Kona or World Championships, they are still pigeonholed into these two little boxes. You know, which box are you going to check? And I thought, it's really disheartening. And especially, I mean, obviously, yes, the sponsors and the prize money. And it sort of brought home that there's still a long way to go. And yet, at least that recognition of, you know what, this actually isn't really, this doesn't work as neatly as it used to. And I think that that's a good thing, because it continues to make everybody think a bit differently. But I really felt for them in that situation of for the awards and the prize money and everything. Like in our races, we do give awards and acknowledgement of where you are in that category. But for them and trying to play the bills, they don't have that opportunity. And I hope that the bigger organizations start to look at that differently. And I mean, you could even say, and what about the Olympics? You know, where do you begin and where do you end? But it is the beginning of a lot more discussions.
There's a proverb and it goes something like, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step, like something like that. So that's where we are. Like, you have to start somewhere, and adding boxes, removing boxes, starting a conversation, it starts somewhere. And it's a journey that I think that we can all be proud of, because we all are saying we want to be on this journey. And just for the athletes, it's outstanding. I just want to quickly just touch on something you said before, Corey, that I really, really loved, is that asking the individuals in this space what they want. And I think that's such an amazing approach, because so many times in the past, when we create or anyone creates kind of registration forms or anything like that, someone decides this is what it should look like. you know, how much crowdsourcing is done in that process, right? Now we have opportunities to go out and say, what should this look like? We're asking you. And that form might change 3, 4, 5 times in the next 10 years. But the fact that you are open to making those changes is exactly what, you know, this space needs.
It's a work in progress for sure.
It's working, because if you think about it, back then, you know, Boston, there was no female marathoners. So doing this now, it won't even be a thing in the future. You mentioned also disputes on virtual races and stuff like that. And this changes, obviously. I won't even just touch on virtual races. I'm speaking in general. To prevent things like that for a regular race, what are those misconceptions that we won't know that you would have in place in order to prevent stuff like this from happening, especially dealing with the elites?
So like, what kind of things do we have in place to make sure it's like,
yeah,
everyone has the same experience or whatnot, yeah, and same route? So some of the standard stuff of just like sanctioning and certifying our courses. I don't know if everyone knows that, but you know, again, those are just like requirements and at any national or competitive level, but also just something that CRS does on a professional level. So all of our, from the zoo run to spring runoff, like any road race we do, we get that professionally certified. So it's an accurate course. And then other fun little things that I don't, for anyone that's participating in the Toronto Waterfront Marathon, is we have mats at all the turns. So again, there's a lot of backs there. We've got the Bayview Extension, we have Lakeshore, you know, all those strips. So you'll notice maybe now if you're running the race, you'll see timing mats at those turns. So we make sure people are hitting those points along the route and not just cutting across. So, and again, every year there are some that come up that our timing company will flag that, you know, you're doing a 10-minute mile and all of a sudden it became a 5-minute mile. Is this realistic? You know, et cetera. But again, it's a very small number of people that happens with, where there's a cut in a course or something like that.
You know, for us, I think, listen, most people want their time to be accurate and correct. And if nothing else, I mean, the mats on the course are a great way to ensure that it is fair and that people can see that we take it seriously. My race is in a park and it could be real easy to cut a corner. And you know what? Theoretically, someone may not know. And just as Charlotte said, like, if all of a sudden you go from one pace to another, you know that something is a bit amiss. But at the end of the day, I'd like to think that most of the runners like to tend to police each other too. And I don't even like the word, but everyone wants it to be fair. Mm-hmm. And I think we collectively come together in that one.
The walking community, I would argue, is a big community that just regulates, you know, a lot. So that was something, again, years and years ago that we heard from our community and said, we need a walking category. We want to see our results. That's important to us to know, you know, we're speed walkers. We're competitive in that sense. So again, you'll see at all of our races, we have these walking categories so that you can see your time against other walkers that are speed walking. It's quite impressive. Yeah,
we weren't aware of that category for myself. I'm not speaking on behalf of JG, but also we spoke to Aristotle. He have blades on his feet and he can participate in the race kind of scenario. So in terms of that, it's covering all the bases there, because as he puts it, as being amputee in Toronto, he's been an advocate in that space in order to make sure that these individuals still feel like they could do all the sports. And the fact that they go first and be able to take it on. My uncle's in the wheelchair and I've been trying to get him to do some sport things and show him that it is still a thing. For anyone else that's listening, that think of it, I'm sure they can have similar or the same experience as a runner.
Totally.
Yeah. I do have maybe kind of one final question before we wrap is, we have you both here, race directors. You've seen a lot in the number of years that you've been at it. You've seen how we've evolved and now we have virtual races. Who knew? And inclusivity. There's so much amazing things that have happened. And running's evolved so much. Racing has evolved so much over the years. So Charlotte, maybe we'll start with you. Like, give us a prediction. Like 5, 10 years out. Like, what do you think something that's gonna happen that like we're not expecting? Well, okay, maybe we're gonna ask you to give away a trade secret. Maybe not, but
Robots everywhere. No, robots, I don't know.
Maybe that's the next thing is like, instead of scanning for temperature for COVID, people are going to be checking for like robotics. Like, you know, what did you get injected with? Anyway, that's a different podcast. But like, where do you think we can take this? Do you think there's a, I mean, we have different shoes now, but is there a future that looks different than this?
I think, you know, again, when we come back to things, everything will be different and in a really good way. You know, again, I think everyone in this pandemic has had time to think and reflect on, you know, is our sport inclusive? You know, we talk about people throwing a pair of shoes on and it's the most inclusive sport, but you take a look at it and you start breaking it down and we're all having these conversations and we see where we're missing the mark in so many ways. And so I think for us, we're excited to see where we can bring this sport to when we get back to in-person racing in so many different ways. And even from a sustainability lens, you know, Corey and I were in Las Vegas in February before the pandemic hit for Running USA. So February 2020, and we were all in this one group chatting about cupless races, like Noon and the Council for Responsible Sport came out with this whole thing. And we're like, that would be incredible. You know how much waste comes from all these cups and water stations and trails already doing it. They're self-sustained, you know, is this something road racing could ever get to? And we're like, oh, the culture is just so ingrained in having us provide an experience that you don't need to do anything for, right? So we're like, how do we change this? And so now we're like, we have an opportunity to implement these things that we were trying to do before the pandemic, I think, and things that we've been considering even more so through the pandemic. So I'm excited to see the change. And I think there's going to be a lot of it for the better, which is great.
I'm glad I didn't have to go first on that question, first of all. I agree with Charlotte. I think we're going to sort of start with a blank slate in many ways. And, you know, some of the things that we just did because we did them probably won't happen. And at the same time, what would be really neat, because of the virtual impact, and I've thought about this and I've seen examples of it, people who can't make it, let's say on race day, because I think we'll have maybe a longer time. Maybe there'll be different opportunities. Maybe there'll be smaller mini races within a bigger one. Or are you enabling people to show up on the course at a certain time? And because of technology, they could do the route and then be considered as part of the race in the in-person component. I think that technology is changing so quickly. And ironically, in some ways, the endurance industry is really on top of it. In other ways, we're still old school. But can we use technology and what's coming down the pipes for something really new and exciting? And I think that would be kind of cool to be able to go on that route and always, through technology, be able to do the route at your own time. Because as we know, like, what if you pick a good day or the wind is in your on your back or, you know, it's not too hot? Like, that would be interesting. I think the other really interesting thing is what if there was no gender idea? What if it just, we looked at things differently based on time? Mm-hmm. There's so many things that we might be able to do. And I think now we can have that chance.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you're both right. This pandemic has given, I think, us all an opportunity to look at things a little bit differently. I think what's going to probably happen is at certain point, cars are going to be off the ground and flying. And you're going to have as much real estate as you need to run races without interrupting anyone. And I think it's going to be an awesome thing. And I can't wait to see that.
Well, sorry, to that point with active TO and stuff, I'm excited about the roads being given back to people like that. We've been fighting that for years, trying to get, you know, again, cars off the roads and people getting to use them for their mental and health and well-being. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, I really hope those are some of the things that stick around after this pandemic, that we have those closures for us to just take over the roads, get on our bikes, walk, run, whatever it might be.
Yeah, because that could be end up being a route to run, because we're doing all the tracking already, right? And there are already technology in the space that you are working in right now that exists, and we may not notice it because it's so effortless. An example, the registration forms. If you're using Race Roster, then you don't have to think about it. You already have an account. So you may be able to just show up at a race and like, oh, I'm just going to run this, and never had to actually pick up a bib or physically registering prior to, you know. So with that, the friction has been gone there, but it also standardized. And that's already a technology investment, because in previous, you had to do a form yourself, right? Whatever company use separately. the tracking would have been different, where you get results and if you get photos. And I ran a race in Berlin. They had the cup idea, but they were reusing cups. So they'll give you one that you could just toss back in the bin. What was really interesting to me was the actual, everyone owned their own chip. So we had to rent it. I was like, well, yeah. Everyone runs, but you own your own chip and you just register it. So that was interesting. So either that they obviously, if you purchase from the same company, then the series will never match. Like the number sequence will never match. But yeah, you just bring it in and register it. So it's still there as an expo and everything like that. But most people already had the chip on their shoes from previous races and just kind of stuff like that. And I'm sure at the expo, there's so much other things that key learnings or our technology company that provided that stuff. But I find that stuff so fascinating. That's why JG and I wanted to speak with you both.
Yeah, I feel like that's like the park runs too, Dre. Like they have, yeah. I think you like just buy into it and you get your chip or whatever, and then you do all these park runs for free. And yeah, I know we were trying to do that in Canada and like Toronto, right, Corey? Like there, it started a little bit before the pandemic, but yeah.
I was on ActiveTO. Was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday morning. I was there early. I don't know. I was there. It was like 7:30, 8 o'clock. It was packed. It was packed. And I'm like, okay, this is unbelievable. It's the second day. It's not super warm. It's really, really early. And it's already crowded. And all I could think about, just to your point, Charlotte, is like, they can't not do this anymore. Like, I can't imagine how, like, it'd just be so sad if we go back to the roads being full of cars when all these people... Like we are into it in Toronto. Like it's just, this is one of the silver linings of COVID for sure.
Yeah. Someone came up to me, I think it was like last May, and I was on, it was at the beginning maybe of ActiveTO or somewhere around there. Anyways, I'm on Lakeshore West and he kind of came up to me and he's like, are you in a race? And my eyes just started watering. Like I was like, I'm not in a race, but thank you. I'm like, I kind of feel like I am, but.
They have no idea.
He was just so pumped that he could be biking on the lakeshore without cars, right? And he was just like, you must be in a race. And he was just like, I can be here too. I'm like, we can all be here. Like, yeah, it was cool.
He had no idea. But I don't know if that taboo there with the fact that there used to be cars, that's what makes it so exciting. I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe.
Thank you so, so much. Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Corey. This has been an extraordinary conversation. You've both been extraordinary guests, and we've learned so much about racing and what you're all thinking about in this space. And I know everybody's antsy. We're going to get there. We're going to turn a corner very soon. Yep. And you know what? And then you're both going to be incredibly busy and not have time for podcasts because you're going to have all these races going up. And that's the world we're going to be in soon. So just, you know, count your blessings now. And before you know it, we'll be out there together running and Alan chasing people on his bicycle and all this great stuff. And, you know, it's a world that's going to come back to life soon. And we're looking forward to it. So, but seriously, thank you both so much for giving us the kind of behind the scenes on races and your race series specifically. So we're really grateful for this opportunity. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us. This is great.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You just validated our podcast. I mean, that being said, this is the longest shine. Peace.
Peace.